This is Tapestry on CBC Radio 1. I'm Mary Hines. If you're listening on satellite radio, you're on Sirius 137. If you're listening to our podcast, hello to you. And thanks for taking us with you, wherever you are. Sharon Salzberg became a student of Buddhism in 1971. She has been leading meditation retreats around the world since 74. She's a co-founder of the Insight Meditation Society in Barrie, Massachusetts. She's also the author of Loving Kindness, The Revolutionary Art of Happiness, and A Heart as Wide as the World, among many other titles. Sharon Salzberg is with me in Toronto. Hi, welcome to Tapestry.
Thank you so much.
I would like to take you back a few years. There you were, young college kid in Buffalo, yearning to explore the more spiritual side of things. And something in Buddhism was calling your name. And it was this idea that anyone can turn his or her life around. It's not just for the special people or the talented people or the jocks or the beautiful people. Why was this such a potent message for the young Sharon Salzberg?
Well, there actually was a prior message which was just as important, which was the Buddha's very unafraid, unashamed acknowledgement of the suffering in life. Because I came from a family, as many people do, where there was tremendous suffering and loss and discord. And like for many people, it was a family system where this was never, ever really spoken about. And so I didn't know what to do with all of those tumultuous feelings I had inside. And here was the Buddha saying right out loud what I clearly knew anyway, but nobody was admitting, which was that there's suffering in life.
And what did that feel like, hearing that out loud? Was it a release or a relief or a, like, finally, someone's speaking the truth of my life?
It was exactly like that. It was an enormous sense of liberation.
I don't think I had, you know, I think people have this pantheon of teachers or Buddhist teachers, and you're one of them. You know, you've been established there for quite a while. And it was a bit shocking to me to see how harsh the early years had been for you. I don't think I'd ever come across that before. Can you set out a little bit for people who aren't familiar with the story? What happened?
Well, a lot happened, really. And it was actually when I was writing this book, Faith, which started out as a somewhat more dry, abstract discussion of faith in the Buddhist tradition. And it was really going nowhere. And an editor said to me, you really have to make it about your faith journey. And my faith journey was definitely rooted in my early childhood and the suffering I went through, which, and when I wrote the book and I kind of calculated, I realized that by the time I left for college at 16, I'd lived in 5 different family configurations. Each of them ended by trauma or shifted by trauma. My parents got divorced when I was 4. I lived with my mother and her siblings. My mother died when I was 9. Then I lived with my paternal grandparents, whom I hardly knew. And then my father came back when I was 11 after my grandfather had died. And within something like 6 weeks, took an overdose of sleeping pills. And he survived, but he spent the rest of his life in some kind of mental health facility or another. And, you know, so it was just these enormous disruptions and this terrible sense of loss. And then I went to college.
So you were ripe for that message of it's not always going to be like this.
Yes.
And this happens. This is awful, but suffering is the way of the world. Was that part of the initial message to you that was so comforting?
Yeah, I mean, it was enormously comforting. And isn't that strange, you know, that kind of just the admission of suffering in such an open way would be so comforting, but it was.
I've always liked your twist on the traditional Buddhist teaching, may all sentient beings be free from suffering. Your version at one point was, well, you know, all sentient beings except for me.
Yeah, sure.
Where do you think that thought comes from, that peace, love, freedom, equanimity, that all the good stuff can't be for someone like me? You know, it's for the real adepts, the holy people, the people who have it figured out. It's for someone else, but heaven knows it's not for me. Where does that come from?
actually think that in many ways it's certainly in the United States, I'd say it's a strong cultural conditioning. Like one of my claims to fame in Buddhist lore is quite a long time ago, in 1989 or 1990, I was at a very small conference with the Dalai Lama in Dharamsala in India with a number of scientists and psychologists and me, and I got the chance to ask him a question. So I said something like, "Your Holiness, what do you think about self-hatred?" And he said, "What is that?" And he was very puzzled. He said, "Is it some kind of nervous disorder?" And it was really, it was a lot of fun, you know, because everyone was jumping to their feet practically and saying, "Well, it's this and that, you know."
Yeah, yeah. Let me tell you all about it.
He was totally puzzled. And he was, and finally he came out at the end with saying something like, "But how can you think of yourself that way? You have Buddha nature. You have Buddha nature. How can you think so little of yourself?" And that's not to say, you know, that everything is perfect, you know, in the East, and that there isn't very painful conditioning, but there isn't that precise conditioning so much, you know, that sense that if we really knew who we were underneath the habits and the disjointed thinking and the emotional cascades, then it would be big trouble, you know.
So my thinking immediately goes to, well, damn, we should have all had Tibetan parents, shouldn't we? We'd be a damn sight healthier.
It's not too late.
Well, in the absence of all of us having nurturing Tibetan parents, in the absence of a whole generation growing up saying, what could self-hatred be? I don't even get the concept. How do you move towards that way of thinking since we didn't all have Tibetan parents?
I think it's discovery. You know, it's not just on the level of trying to change one's thinking, although that can be very helpful, but it's actually seeing oneself in a very different light.
It sounds easy when a teacher says it. Was it easy for you? Was it?
No, it wasn't easy for me.
I want to hear that laugh again. That was very eloquent. Was it easy? No, not exactly.
No, it's not easy. But it's possible. Isn't that the most amazing thing? You know, that it's absolutely possible wherever we've come from or whatever we've gone through, that we can transform our minds and we can relate very differently to ourselves and to others.
Tell me if I'm remembering this correctly. I'm thinking in one of your earlier books, you were at an event. Were you in a cast at some point? The Dalai Lama sees you. He comes running up to you. "Sharon, what happened? You're hurt."
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
In the midst of what? Hundreds of people.
It was a few hundred people.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what a moment. Just that kind of heart on his sleeve concern, eh?
Yeah.
What was that? Was that in Barrie?
That was in Barrie. It was 1979. It was, I think it was his first trip to the United States, actually. And he was coming to Amherst, which is about 45 minutes away. And we heard that. And so we sent off an invitation to his private office saying, "Well, hey, we're a Buddhist center. You know, maybe you'd like to come here." And to our amazement, we got a letter back saying, "Yeah, he'll come." And even though security in those days was nothing like it is now, still it was quite considerable. I had been in a car accident not that long before and had a broken bone in my foot, and I was using crutches, which I was not very skillful with. So the day came and there were 100 to 200 people standing outside waiting for him, and I was way in the back and feeling very badly. You know, I thought, "Oh, I'm back here, you know, I'm stuck in the back, and I helped start the place. I should be up front, but I'm such a klutz. You know, I'll fall on my face if I'm up front. I better stay in the back. But, oh, no, I'm in the back. It's so terrible." And when his car came, he just got out of the car. And I don't know, he seems to have a kind of radar for who in a crowd might be suffering the most. And that was me. So he just got out of the car. He cut through 100 people or more, came up to me and took my hand and looked me in the eye and said, "What happened?"
Aww.
So it was actually a very important moment for me, because I think it was the moment that actually redefined my sense of what compassion is, because I realized he couldn't make the injury not have happened, and he couldn't make me any more skilled in my use of crutches, but that horrible, corrosive feeling of being so stuck in the back, so unseen, so uncared for, it was gone.
There was... There was a moment for you. It's just a couple of days before you're set to go to India for the first time, I believe, when you were in Buffalo. And there to your campus in Buffalo comes the Tibetan master, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. He's giving a talk at the college, and they've asked for written questions to be submitted. And one of young Sharon Salzberg's questions is plucked out and asked. And it's along the lines of, hey, I'm going to India to study meditation. What, you know, where should I go? Do you have any ideas? And do you remember his answer?
Oh, absolutely. it was very funny because he, you know, this big pile of questions, and he just pulled that one out and he read it out loud, and he was silent for a few moments, and then he said, I think you had perhaps best follow the pretense of accident. And that was it. You know, no monastery guidebook, no handy directory.
No, see my pal on the second peak from the left.
That's right. You just go up the hill, and, you know, it was nothing. It was just
the pretense of accident. Now, yeah. did that mean anything to you at the time?
It meant nothing to me. It really meant nothing to me, but it was precisely the way everything unfolded. You know, I went to India, and I knew the Dalai Lama lived in Dharamsala, so I went there, and it was quite beautiful and really extraordinary, but it was also one of those circumstances, you know, where things just don't work for you. So there was a quite wonderful teacher there. And I was, you know, I should also say that I was very interested in the pragmatic, practical tools of meditation. I wanted to know how to transform my mind. I wasn't that interested in Buddhism or the philosophy or scholarship or...
It was give me something that works.
That's right. Give me something I can do. Yeah. Give me something I can try. So I had a very definite need for a certain kind of circumstance. And so I'd go to these classes to learn how to meditate, and only to find out, you know, the translator had left town for 2 weeks, or the Lama had to go to the dentist who was on the other end of India, you know. So I waited and waited, and it never really happened. But while I was in Dharamsala, I went to a restaurant one day, and I overheard somebody describing this international yoga conference, which was going to take place in New Delhi in a few weeks. So I thought, I'll go there. That's where I'll find my teacher. So I went there, and that was a very dispiriting experience. The low point came when all these swamis and and yogis were pushing and shoving against each other to try to grab the mic to be the first to speak, you know.
Well,
and
that's inspiring.
Oh, God, you know, like,
teach me.
Stayed in Buffalo, you know, like, what's this about?
But you're at a Bills game at this point,
that's right?
Right.
You know, but while I was there at this conference, someone named Dan Goleman, who's since become, you know.
Has he become Daniel Goleman?
Yeah,
the best-selling writer.
That's right. He was a graduate student in psychology at the time, and he was delivering a paper. He was doing some research on meditation, and so he was delivering a paper at this conference, this yoga conference, and he mentioned that he was on his way to a town called Bodh Gaya, which is the town that's grown up around the tree the Buddha was sitting under when he became enlightened, and he was going to do this intensive 10-day meditation retreat, which was supposed to be very secular, very practical, really like an immersion course in meditation. And I thought, that's what I need. So I just followed him, basically, to Bodh Gaya, and that was the beginning of my practice.
In your book, Loving Kindness, you write about one of these once-in-a-lifetime moments, actually under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya. So this was the tree?
Mm-hmm. It's the descendant. I think it's the third generation.
A descendant of the tree under which the Buddha is said to have sat and reached his enlightenment.
Yeah.
I'm almost looking for a bit of a travelogue here before I ask the question. What's it like as you approach it? Is it a tourist site? Is it overrun? Is it peaceful? Do you know you're in a some sort of a sacred spot when you're there?
I found it just extraordinary. There's a beautiful temple that's been built just behind the tree. And as my friend Joseph Goldstein says, the beauty of the temple is commensurate with what happened there. It's just extraordinarily lovely.
You so often hear of pilgrimage spots that it's beautiful until you reach the lineup of people hawking, you know, little souvenir Buddhas or this or that. Does it suffer from the scourge of being a really beloved spot, or does it still carve out that sense of there's something sacred, there's something solemn, or is it, you know, is it a zoo, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Well, it's both. In those days, in the early 70s, there was virtually nothing. And when I went back, I think 79, and then in the 80s, it had changed considerably. And so there was much more of like, oh, buy a Bodhi leaf, you know, buy this. Or there's a tradition in some Buddhist places of releasing animals, you know, as a kind of blessing, you know. So instead of the animal being killed, you're releasing it. So buy this fish, you know, or like buy this bird or something like that. So this, you know,
in order to release it.
In order to release it, yeah, yeah.
A few years ago, you were on a meditation retreat with some friends. You all rented a house by the ocean, and you had an epiphany moment when you walked into your allotted bedroom. You look down and you see a comic strip. It's Peanuts. And I'm thinking of all the places to find this moment of enlightenment. Charles Schulz, thank you. Tell me about the comic strip. What did you see that day?
Well, it was someone had left it on the desk, I think the previous tenant. And so I walked in, and in the first frame of the comic, Lucy is talking to Charlie Brown, and she says, you know, Charlie Brown, what your problem is, the problem with you is that you're you. And then in the second frame, poor Charlie Brown looks at her and says, well, what in the world can I do about that? And then in the third and final frame, Lucy looks at him and says, I don't pretend to be able to give advice. I merely point out the problem.
You can just hear Lucy,
yes,
right?
I know. Yeah. It's like, and somehow, whenever I walked by that desk, my eye would fall on that very line. The problem with you is that you're you, because that had been such a dominant voice in my life. It's almost like that was the narrative until I went to India and began meditation and had a whole other sense of a narrative about what my life was about and who I was and so on. So, but it was very useful for me because subsequent to that, various things would happen, like something really good would happen, and I'd hear this kind of carping voice in my head that would say, it's never going to happen again, something like that.
Enjoy it while it lasts.
That's right. I'd say, hi, Lucy, you know, like, or chill out, Lucy. That became my favorite, like, chill out, Lucy. Mm,
so you'd identify it as the Lucy voice.
It was the Lucy voice.
How long did that persist? I mean, because you took to the Buddhist tradition and the teachings in a really serious way pretty early on once you went to India. Does the Lucy voice persist even in the face of educating yourself and study and meditation and all this work, all this inner work that you were doing, and Lucy still doesn't shut up?
I think Lucy persists, but it doesn't matter. You know, because it's like, I was actually very proud of that chill out Lucy because I thought it was just the right tone.
Yeah,
you know, there's even a little tenderness in there, and there's certainly recognition. Oh, I see you. You're Lucy. But it's also not, you're taking over, fine, you know. That's not happening either.
Your field is metta meditation, your specialty.
Yeah.
Loving kindness practice. And you've written something I find really intriguing about one of the practices. I think we need to set this up a little bit. This is about the neutral person and the effect the neutral person could end up having on one. Who is the neutral person in loving kindness practice?
A neutral person is somebody we don't especially like or dislike. We just feel kind of neutral toward them.
And so within the context of the metta practice, could you take us through a little bit of this perhaps, how one would embark upon a metta session?
Well, often, I mean, in many meditation practices, there's some object that we gather our attention around, we gather our energy around, and that might be something like the feeling of the breath, or it could be a mantra, it could be a visualization, but we gather all of our normally scattered and, you know, wild attention and energy, we just gather it around this object, and usually we find it's not that long. You know, before we're out there again. And so we need to gently let go of whatever distraction and just bring our attention back to that object. So in the specific method that's loving-kindness meditation, rather than it being the feeling of the breath or another object, it's usually the silent repetition of certain phrases, which are the expressions of the heart. It's like an expression of interest, of acknowledgement, of connection. So they're very simple phrases, maybe something like, may I be happy or may you be happy, something like that. And classically, we start with ourselves and we offer loving kindness to ourselves through these phrases. And then we move through various categories of beings until we end with the extension of loving kindness to all beings everywhere, to all of life. So maybe we start with ourselves and then move to a benefactor, someone who's helped us, and then a friend, and then on to a neutral person before we get to a more difficult person, and then all beings.
Because it does move through a difficult person or someone to whom you bear ill will. This
yes.
is not soft stuff.
Yeah.
This is, you know, may that schmuck around the corner be well and find happiness.
That's
and
right.
You've said that some of the loveliest stories you hear mm-hmm. arise from the idea of the neutral person. Can you mm-hmm. tell me a little bit about what you've heard on retreat from people?
Well, I love the neutral person. Very often people not on retreat will choose someone who plays a certain role in their life that they just see now and then, and they don't feel much for. So
the guy at the gas station,
yeah,
the woman who pours your cup of coffee in
that's
the
right.
morning at the...
That's
yeah.
right. You know, and so what we're effectively doing in that part of the meditation is stopping and actually paying attention to somebody that we might normally ignore. And everything ensues from paying attention.
You tell this story about sometimes someone will be on retreat and come up to you and say, hey, listen, you know, nothing's happening. I don't feel anything. My neutral person, I'm saying that, you know, no, I just don't feel anything. And then a couple of days later, well, hey, my neutral person missed breakfast this morning. Can you go check on
That's
her?
Right.
'Cause I think she's sick. I'm kind of worried about my neutral person. What's happening? Does that happen? I mean, you see kind of attention blossoming into something or taking root somehow?
Oh, definitely. My favorite story, actually, about the neutral person is I teach usually a 7-day intensive retreat at the center I co-founded, the Insight Meditation
yes.
Society in Barrie, every winter in loving kindness meditation. So people come and it's like an immersion into that method. And we go through all those various categories. So many years ago, maybe 8 years ago now, I had a friend sit that retreat. And then I didn't see her again for like 6 months or something like that. And I ran into her again when I was teaching another retreat in New Mexico, and she came up to me in New Mexico, and she was all kind of like beaming and shiny, and she said to me, I've fallen in love with my dry cleaner. And I said, oh, really? And I got really excited, you know, thinking, oh, they're dating, you know. And then she could tell what I was thinking, and she said, no, not romantically, but he was my neutral person back in that retreat, and, you know, that I did in Barrie. And she said, now, every single day when I meditate, I hold him in my heart, and I wish him well. And I go into the store, and I really want to know how he's doing. It's like it means something to me, like, how are you doing? So, you know.
And she's glowing.
Yeah, she's glowing, you know. And then, I don't know how long went by, maybe a couple of years went by, and I was asked to write an article about loving kindness for a magazine. And I happened to run into her again. I hadn't seen her. And I said, oh, is it okay if I tell your story? And she said, oh, yeah. And she said, you know, I still go into the stores. This is like now 2 years later.
Oh.
She said, I still go into the store and I still want to see, like, is everything okay? You know, how's it going? And you know, so that was really wonderful. And then another couple of years went by and I didn't see her. And then I ran into her again. And I said, how's your dry cleaner? And she said, you know, I still go into the store and I still have this feeling like, how's he doing? And then she said, I've moved on to the UPS person, you know. So I thought, wow, one by one, we can conquer the world.
Well, I guess because technically her beloved dry cleaner is no longer so neutral.
That's right.
Is that it?
That's right.
You have to then move him to
yeah.
the beloved person category.
Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful. Krishna Das was on the show a while back, and he's in the acknowledgments, I think, to your book, Faith.
Mm-hmm.
And you thank him for providing the soundtrack
yeah.
as you're writing.
Yeah.
What does the sound of chant do for you?
Well, Krishna Das is a very old friend. He, along with many of my friends, like Joseph, I met at my very first retreat in Bodh Gaya in January of 1971.
Oh, what a crowd this was.
Yeah, that was great. Oh. I always feel like it's a little bit like that door swinging open again, you know, and I remember things that maybe I've been out of touch with, you know, about a sense of possibility and expansiveness and connection and love and so on. So I listened to his, when I was writing Faith, which included a chapter on despair, which was, you know, certainly difficult to write at, you know, something like 2 a.m, things like that.
Because that's when you would write a chapter on despair.
Yeah, that's right. Perfect. Yeah. I'd be listening to his chanting and it would get me through, you know.
It's a delight to hear you talk. Sharon Salzberg, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much.